Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by Scale Up Consulting, helping FinTech startups create a scalable organization to support an ever-increasing demand. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@scaleupconsulting.co. Now, over to the show with Richard Doty, founder and host.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Scaling Up Show, where we talk to world-class operators and we get their insights as to how they're scaling up their business, but also, importantly, how they're scaling up themselves. And really excited today to welcome Tobias. Tobias is the founder and CEO of Trading TV. He's out in New York City, so high fives to everyone out in New York City. You know, prior to founding Trading TV, you know, Tobias has had a pretty cool career. He worked in Wall Street, right? He's worked at some of the biggest investment banks in Wall Street, and obviously he decided to make the leap and take on the challenge and really start and grow a business. So, Tobias, mate, stoked to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Okay, cool. Listen, before we press play, we were talking about entrepreneurship and the fact that you felt at a point in time that, you know, was a bit, you know, far away from you and something that maybe, you know, was out of your grasp. So tell me, what led you to founding a business and specifically founding a business in the financial markets, right? Trading.tv.
Yeah, absolutely. So I came from a underprivileged background. So didn't have like a lot of people around me that were making a ton of money, that were founders, that were in venture capital, that were on Wall Street. So to me, this thing really only existed in TV shows or in movies or in books. And there wasn't really a tangibility to it. So I kind of just progressed through my life. First in the pursuit of a professional athletics career, I played hockey growing up. And then once I was successful in playing hockey, I was able to earn a scholarship to a prep school. And when I went to prep school, for the first time, I was around people that actually were financially successful, or at least their parents were financially successful. And I started to just really immerse myself in the business side of these people's lives. I was very interested in what they were doing for a living and how they were able to create this amazing lifestyle for themselves. And I really started to gravitate towards sort of Wall Street, finance, technology, venture capital, hedge funds. And that was my first introduction into the world. So when I went to college, I knew immediately that I wanted to study that, became a finance and alternative asset management major at SMU, and was able to get an internship at a local hedge fund. And that was I was off to the races. You know, I took to it very, very quickly, was successful through the entire operation of my collegiate career, and then ended up at Goldman Sachs with an internship, and then Morgan Stanley for my first full-time gig. And when I was at Morgan Stanley, it was an amazing time because social media was just becoming this investable asset classes. And for the first time, you had companies that were founded by 22-year-olds or, you know, younger even. And they were multi-billion dollar businesses within a few years. And no one that was on the desk that had 20 years of experience could say, oh, you don't get it. You know, it wasn't like a DuPont or like a ExxonMobil. In fact, it was the exact opposite. The older guys didn't get it. They're like, what is this Facebook? You know, like, what are you guys doing? You know, and it was a really amazing opportunity. So they said, you know, you're young and you're hungry and you actually use these products. So like, why don't you become sort of the resident expert in this social media space. Right place, right time for me, and was a very good thing for my career. And I've always studied social media and fintech and focused on that as a subset of technology. So in 2019, 2020, I felt a shift that was happening in the world. People, like the first 9 years of my career, none of my friends had been texting me about stocks or, you know, trading or whatever. And then in 2019, it felt like everyone started to get on Robinhood and, you know, Wall Street Bets started to take off and whatever. And my job was culturally relevant for the first time in my career. So I started to study like what this actually meant. And there was sort of a few different takeaways, but the two primary ones were the creator economy is here and it's here to stay because this generation just doesn't buy into the notion that like the right way to live your life is to get a job at, you know, some big corporate company, work a 9-to-5, contribute to your 401k, blah, blah, blah. Like they just don't want to do it. They want to pursue their passions and they want to figure out a way to be able to monetize those. And then on the other side, you know, for people that can't be creators, they want to take ownership of their financial life through trading and investing so that they can expedite their exit from the rat race. So when I looked in the market for something that was at the intersection of those two mega trends, two secular trends that were going to last at least, you know, for the next decade or two, there was nothing. And so that's what Trading TV is. It's a social fintech platform that sits at the intersection of the creator economy and the retail trading revolution.
Brilliant. And, you know, going back to, you maybe even when you're younger, you're with your folks and, you know, your family. I mean, did you ever imagine yourself leading and founding a business in the sort of in the tech space, in the fintech space? I mean, what was your, you know, when you're 6 or 10 or even, you know, 17, what did you actually want to do when you grew up?
Yeah, well, I've always been, I think, you know, it's sounds like a little bit hubris when I was about to say it, but I've always been like a natural born leader. Like I was always captain of whatever athletic team I was on. And I really enjoy, you know, being a leader. I really enjoy helping people, being a part of a team. So I never thought of it as like, hey, I'm going to become a CEO or a founder, but I knew that within like whatever circle I was a part of, I wanted to be a major contributor and, you know, help people achieve whatever the goals or the outcome that they desired was. And then, you know, as I went through my career, the early parts of it, I felt like held back by being in corporate America because they have like a very structured system associated with, oh, like, you know, the primary decision about who's like leading the group tends to be like who's been there the longest.
Who's the oldest, right?
Yeah, who's the oldest. That like seems like a pretty shitty way to make a big decision on who should be leading a particular group. And I just, you know, I hit the glass ceiling at some point and I said, okay, well, I'm just going to go and do something on my own because I'm capable and you know, I'm willing and able and I can get this done. So that was like when I really made the leap.
And you mentioned early on, you came from an underprivileged background. And it's interesting you say that because I can sort of relate to that. I grew up in post-apartheid South Africa, right?
Okay.
And it was a time when there was a lot of change. Nelson Mandela had just been released from prison and change was in the air. There wasn't much on offer for a lot of different people in my category, a white man growing up in Africa, right? That was from a single parent who was struggling all the time, had sort of held three jobs at one point just to put my brother and myself through school. And, you know, I clearly remember I don't want to call it the walk I had to walk or the path I had to take compared to maybe some of the others that, you know, I was associated with who had, you know, maybe a better financial backing than me. You know, I had to, as an example, I remember having to start off and work with import satellites from mainland China and bring them into Africa. I mean, God forbid, who wants to do that? I did it, though. It got me a plane ticket to Ireland. And then from there, gradual steps, one by one by one, building up the capital, the money, and also getting educated, you know, I was able to get to where I wanted to go and climb that ladder. And I think I like what you're saying, you know, start finding the people, start finding the circle of friends and advisors and people and mentors that you can learn off. So, you know, how did that journey look for you? I mean, I know you trailblazed it a bit, but what was that path like?
Yeah. So once I was playing hockey and, you know, every single day I was trying to do as much as I could to become a great hockey player, because in my head, I thought there was only two ways out of a bad financial situation. One was entertainment, so being an actor or rapper or whatever. And the second was athletics. And, you know, just to pause on that for a moment, like, one of the big things I want to do with Trading TV is really sort of spread the narrative around the opportunities that exist for young minorities outside of entertainment and athletics. I think it's great that a lot of young people are in athletics or are pursuing a career in the arts, but we all collectively need for young kids that are growing up in underprivileged neighborhoods to think mm-hmm. about, you know, becoming the next Mark Zuckerberg or, you know, the next big VC, Mark Andreessen or whoever. And to those folks and the people in those situations, yeah. it doesn't feel like a tangible, real thing. And it mm-hmm. very much is. And I think the proliferation of...
Why do you think, sorry to cut you off, but so, because it is interesting, right? And I'm not a student on sort of how America sets up and how the states are set up, but I know from my own experience, being a little kid coming out of South Africa, you know, these things just seem so far away.
But, definitely.
You know, how can we as, you know, a community make it closer? What are your insights on that?
Well, that's what the platform, that's what Trading TV is really about, is bringing these people together, right? Yeah. I mean, like in a lot of ways, you know, the old saying of like out of sight, out of mind is very true. Yeah. You know, you kind of become a product of your environment, unfortunately. Yeah. So if you grow up in Silicon Valley and, you know, your parents are venture capitalists or founders, or work at, you know, a startup, then like that just seems normal, right? Like you go to work at a company that has 5 people or 10 people and it scales to 5,000 and the company goes from, you know, a $1 million valuation to a $10 billion valuation. And like, you know, that is what it is.
It's like having eggs for breakfast, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like if you grow up in, you know, an underprivileged neighborhood where everyone's working, you know, minimum wage jobs or they're in the service industry and like, you know, your mom was working 3 jobs, like the notion of starting a technology company or any other business that has the potential to have a $1 billion valuation just seems like completely rocket science and out of touch. So with our platform, like we want to actually show people both, you know, on the trading, the investing side, but hopefully have venture capitalists that are doing podcasts and things like that, so that this becomes a real thing. And once you build that community, then people start to look at it as something that is achievable and that's something that's tangible and that they can do. And, you know, for me, it was really about once I started to get into these circles when I was playing hockey and then went to prep school for the first time, you know, I didn't feel like blown away. Like I thought I would be like, you know, blown away because these people are computer science wizards and like a few of them are, don't get me wrong. Yeah. But most of the time I kind of felt like, these are normal people that have extraordinary, you know, jobs and extraordinary wealth. But like the biggest part about achieving that was getting started and injecting yourself with confidence into the conversation and, you know, sort of kicking the door in if you needed to. And then you're in the room and eventually you go from being in the room to being at the table to being at the head of the table. Yeah. And so, you know, I think like the connection to people that are in and around the hoop, so to speak, is a really big important step towards being able to change what young people in underprivileged neighborhoods view as a realistic outcome for their life and career.
Confidence is an interesting word, right? Because, you know, I think in society in general, there's this feeling that if you're not big, if you're not maybe the Zuckerberg or, you know, the Musk of these world, you can't actually reach out to someone and go, listen, you know, I like what you're doing. I want to join up, or I've got a solution for you. And, you know, how do you build up that confidence? You know, was it, you know, obviously you had hockey, you said you're a natural leader. It sounds like you did pretty good at university. What is the magic sauce that you can give us that will help others?
Yeah, I don't know if I have any magic sauce because I've always, for better or worse, been a little bit, I've always been self-confident. I've never really approached things from the mentality of pessimism or thinking that I couldn't do something. But I do agree with you that having the confidence to reach out, like that first phone call, is a big first step towards changing your life. And one of the things I've said a lot, you know, as I've been speaking and things like that, is that in the world today, because of technology, whether it's LinkedIn or Twitter or whatever, most of the time you're less than 3 people removed from any person that you want to get in contact with. Yeah. So a really great exercise that I would recommend for anybody that's looking to change their circumstances, to break into an industry, to get a job at a startup, or to become a founder, reach venture capital, whatever, is writing down a list of 10 people and make it absurd. Like write Elon Musk at the top, you know, like, right, Michelle Obama, right? And like, you have a list of these 10 people. And then from there, you can kind of socially graph. You can go on, you know, LinkedIn, go on Twitter and like figure out who knows these people and sort of network your way in. And one of the interesting things I found out pretty early in my career, like a little secret, is when you call these super successful people, like if you can, you know, figure out an email or a phone number or whatever, the response rate is extremely high. It's extremely, extremely high, because once you reach a certain point of financial success, you know, like the extra, like, does Elon really care about, you know, like an extra, like he made $16 billion yesterday and like Tesla stock going, like, he doesn't care. It doesn't matter. Yeah. So what do they actually find joy in? What makes them happy? And it's usually giving back in some capacity or nice. Or lending, you know, lending, like, it doesn't need to be like money, but like just lending 15 or 20 minutes towards of their time towards like an entrepreneur or somebody. And I felt that that was the main difference between entrepreneurship, technology, and Wall Street, is that people on Wall Street are very like me. Yeah. And, you know, everyone's like trying to knife fight each other for like an extra whatever on their bonus. And in technology, the entrepreneurs that are truly successful, that have been able to reach sort of stratosphere level, have approached every single interaction with the mentality that they're going to give more than they get. It's just interesting because if you do that earnestly, you end up getting a lot more than you give.
Yeah, totally with you on that. And is there one person that you reached out to on your journey, climbing up and figuring out your path, that you remember, yeah, bam, that's the guy or that's the girl that really sort of unlocked it for me?
I don't think there was like one person in particular. I mean, you know, I think that there was a trader that I had done a lot of business with when I was in college that I, you know, basically begged them for an internship at Goldman. And, you know, I was at non-target school. So like Goldman and these bigger banks are very notorious for only recruiting at like a small handful of schools. It's basically like Ivy League plus Stanford. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I was at a non-target school. So like, you didn't have to worry about going to work at Goldman Sachs. The answer was no. They weren't even going to come and interview on campus. But I was lucky in that I had this internship, and so we were doing some business with Goldman, and you know, I developed a relationship there. And I said, hey man, like I need a favor, like I need to get into the internship program there. And you know, that one favor, or whatever you want to call it, was a life changing event for me, because then I was in the game, right? You know, like getting back to kind of figuring out a way to make a space for yourself in the room. Like now I was playing. And from there, it just became about competing. And like, I was never intimidated by the fact that somebody like went to Harvard or like, you know, went to MIT. Sure, like they're smart, but at a certain level, like we're all, you know, we're all smart. Like, you know what I mean? Like there's a certain,
you're probably a better sportsman than them anyway.
Yeah.
Better hockey player.
Exactly.
But yeah, that's interesting. It's similar. I remember when I came overseas, and you know, I was doing lots of different things. I was 20 years old, and you know, I tried to start up a golf business, and I was working behind a bar, and you know, I traveled a bit, and I was just, my folks are like, hey, you like, well, what's going on here? You need to get some direction. Okay, I'm going to get some direction. And finally, I actually got in touch with someone at Accenture, and you know, still to today we keep in touch, and he gave me, you know, he sort of opened the door and gave me an opportunity to go and work there, and I worked there for a number of years. A really nice guy. And I remember getting in there and like, yeah, very similar story to you. Everyone's like, yeah, where's this guy from? He's not from Oxford or Cambridge, but he's here, and he's actually doing an okay. He's sort of doing an okay gig. Yeah, actually, he's sort of up there as well. And, you know, I remember walking in, also, in a way, freaking out. I'm like, you know, in my head, I was thinking, Oxford and Cambridge? I'll never, ever, you know, meet people from there. But hey, lo and behold, I was there, and we're on the same projects, and now I'm friends with them. And, you know, I think very similar stories. It's the same thing as you were saying. If I didn't, you know, build up the courage and just think, you know, fuck that, Let's go for it. You know, maybe I'll still be working in a bar, which is not a good, not a bad thing. It was, no. It was pretty good. It was a pretty good time in my life, if I'm honest with you. Yeah, but similar stories, right?
Yeah, no, it's great. I think that is the first step, is like identifying people that that you want to be, and figuring out a way to contact them, or people that you admire. And you know, I think it's like something that most moms say to their kids on the first day of kindergarten. It's like, you know, you're the average of your five closest friends, or like, you know, if you like get in a room with nine winners and you're going to be the 10th winner, get in a room with nine losers, you're going to be the 10th loser. Like, it's kind of true. And I think in life, you know, your network really does become your net worth. And so that has to be something that you're constantly looking to, you know, to change and to be around higher quality people and more successful, and not get stuck in complacency. Like, I think a lot of times people reach a certain level in their life and they say like, this is okay. And like, I'm just going to accept it. And that's fine. Like, you know what I mean? Like, for some people, it's like, you can just get into an environment where you say like, I don't need anything else. And like, I kind of am comfortable and I don't really want to fight the fight, because the truth is that entrepreneurship is a battle. It's a mental battle. It's a physical battle. It's difficult to be able to stay motivated day in, day out. And depending on where you're at in your entrepreneurial journey, you also have a huge responsibility to the people that work for you. And that becomes something that, you know, is really heavy on my mind on a daily basis. Like, I've always been the type of person where I'm comfortable managing my own personal risk, meaning like, if I take a risk and I'm unsuccessful, I'm willing to deal with the consequences of that, right? Because I gave it a go, and I always attack everything with 100% ferocity. But now I'm at a point where, you know, I've got 25 people that are, you know, their livelihoods depend on my decisions. And like, a year from now, hopefully that's 50 or 100. And as the business scales, like, the magnitude of the consequences of your decisions also scale. Outside of your own personal circumstances.
I like what you're saying there, because you know, being a founder of a business and being a CEO of a business, you know, you have the responsibility to lead yourself, to lead a team, and to move forward. You need to. And if you don't want to have that responsibility, you know, you need to think long and hard before you sort of you open up a business and build it up. Because you don't want to be, you definitely do not want to be in a situation where you don't like the business you created, right? Because that's just going to lead one way. And so sometimes it happens, right? But the reason it happens is, you know, there's this word delegation, and there's this other word called responsibility. You can't just delegate to everyone and hope things are going to happen. You need to know what the fuck's going on before. You need to know what your hats are, and you need to know how to build those hats out and really sort of build that team up, right? And then you get the power of the team, because people actually want to be part of that journey and want to be part of that success.
Yeah, I think the toughest part is putting yourself in the mental framework for when things are not successful, meaning like firing people, you know, that are underperforming. Like, most of the time you go through your life and you're worried about getting fired, or like, you know, dealing with like a company or whatever that doesn't have the ability to be able to promote you or whatever the case is. And so like, your mind is constantly thinking through that aspect. And then all of a sudden, boom, you're in a leadership position, and now you're evaluating people, you're evaluating their productivity, and you're having to make difficult decisions. And in startup land, unfortunately, like, the vast majority of startups are extremely lean operations that need to have material individual contributors in every single role. And there's a saying in Silicon Valley that, you know, you hire slow, fire fast. And nothing is more true. Like, somebody who's in a position that is not contributing in a meaningful way to the team can slow the entire business down at the early stages by weeks, months, years, and that becomes existential. And so really trying to think about how your leadership style is going to affect every different member of the team, and like, what you're going to do with underperforming, you know, employees and things like that, is super, super difficult, and not something that I think there's no way to prepare for it. It sucks.
And how did you make the shift? Because you came from the corporate world. You came from Goldman's. I mean, this is like the institution of banking, right? How did you make the flip from sort of that corporate worker to startup founder, and
yeah,
totally different philosophy in both worlds, right?
You just totally. It was, there's, I mean, 100% in my mind, I would have never became a founder if COVID hadn't happened. So, you know, obviously COVID was a terrible situation for the world, but for me personally, it gave me the opportunity to kind of step back from what was my day-to-day super busy reality, 100% focused on, you know, working in a big investment bank, and kind of like take stock of what was important in my life and what I wanted to do. And, you know, I'd always had this entrepreneurial itch where I was like, I want to be a founder, but I didn't have like a, you know, an idea that I felt was really worth pursuing. And then like kind of getting back to what we just talked about, I was comfortable in my situation. I was like, you know, making good money. Like I live in New York City. I'm sort of happy. I can go on vacation wherever I want. And it didn't seem like a need to rock the boat. And then when COVID happened, I started to like really evaluate what I wanted to do with whatever the post-COVID world looked like. And kind of just thinking about the fragility of everyone's situation and how easily, you know, your circumstances can be flipped on its head. And I looked at myself and I said, like, look, if there's a moment in time where, you know, you're actually going to become an entrepreneur, then like now's it. And if you're not going to do it, then like, stop lying to yourself. You know, like you're not an entrepreneur if you don't take this opportunity, because I had so much time in my day. Like we went from, you know, working an insane amount of hours per week to in effect having nothing to do, right? Like we were, you know, you went from having to be in an office at whatever, you know, 6 a.m., 7 a.m. to being at your house for 24 hours a day, right? So that was what gave me the opportunity in terms of being able to like sit down and actually put a business plan together and start to think about how we were going to execute it against this.
And the flip, I mean, so corporate world, corporate mentality, the politics, trying to climb up that ladder.
Fucking hate that, by the way. Like the absolute worst.
So, because that's a world you knew. And then startup, you have to build a culture. You have to have, you know, the responsibility to lead a team. Have you used anything? I'm sure you have. What are the skills you've taken from that corporate world? And what are the new things you brought in to your startup that's making things, you know, move forward in a better direction than maybe they would do if you sort of on Wall Street in a bank?
Yeah. I mean, I think the major benefit of being in a startup is what you talked about, which is being able to actually have a culture where people believe in what you're doing. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm sure there's some companies that actually are able to maintain great corporate culture as they become gigantic enterprises, but there's a difference between this ragtag group of rebels, you know, 10, 15, 20, 50 people who are just like maniacally focused on achieving one thing, right? And like a business like Barclays or wherever I was working at that has 30,000 people in it, like there's zero culture at a big enterprise like that, other than, you know, knowing that you need to compete with your coworker to be able to try to, you know, get a little bit more on your bonus or whatever, right? So when I looked at the structure of corporate America, like the main takeaway for me is that people don't want to be here. You know what I mean? Like the main takeaway,
surviving,
that,
right?
Like, yeah. Like they fucking hate their job. And so the amount of effort that they're putting in on a daily basis is probably in a lot of ways reflective of the fact that they just don't want to do it. So the question I asked myself was, how do we build a business and a culture where people are, you know, I don't need to tell them to work hard because they just actually, they love it. And, you know, I think a big part of that is finding like-minded people that have a passion for, in this case, you know, financial markets, but not in like the commercial sense, like, you know, has a lot more to do with crypto and NFTs and, you know, that, and then also want to help, you know, bring accessibility to those markets to millions of people around the world and change their financial circumstances. And so for me, it's less about, hey, is your background perfect for a fintech business, and more like, you know, like, have you coded in this language, or, you know, have you like been a salesperson in this, and more about like, are you passionate about what we're building and what our mission is?
I like it. And then you have relevant and you have relevant conversations with the guys and the girls that come in, because, you know, if they aren't, then yeah, maybe this is not the journey for you, but if they are, they're fully in, right? And then you get the power of the team. And you start building, you start incrementally building quicker.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the famous TED Talk that has the whole mantra of like, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And like, I think that like so true, you know, like the companies that are successful now.
Yeah.
And like I was mentioning to you off camera before, this whole NFT NYC event that's going on right now, like culturally, there's a movement that's going on, and the businesses that are started that just happen to be in that industry are beneficiaries of this massive cultural shift that's happening. And when you have the win, like, you know, one of my mentors said, like, when you're in business, like, it's always better to have the wind in your sails, you know, like don't be sailing against the wind. Right. Yeah. So like a lot of people take this like pessimistic worldview, you know, like NFTs are going to zero, like all you kids are idiots. And it's like, okay, like, I guess like that's a view. Yeah. It's like the same,
it's not thing the right like, one, but it's,
a yeah, view. That, yeah. Like same thing as like the internet, you know, people are like this is never going to be a thing, but even if you are a pessimist and like, okay, over time, like maybe that's the right view. There's going to be $100 billion companies that are going to be founded and scaled before like anything happens. So it's just easier to kind of understand what's culturally relevant at that moment and go with the flow, so to speak. And I think like that's what you want to attract when you're building a business. It's like people that actually believe in this underlying movement.
Yeah, I love it. And I'm going to bring in an analogy here. It's sort of back in 95, showing my age maybe. I was in school and Nelson Mandela walked onto stage and gave us a speech. And, you know, he said to us, he said, guys, listen, you know, it was an all boys school. You know, he's chatting to all of us. And so he said, guys, listen, you all have a path to choose. But I'll tell you what, this is the path I'm going to choose. I'm going to choose a path of reconciliation. And this is why I'm going to do it, because in South Africa at that time and still today, there is a lot of potential in each and every individual here, right? So you either can come along for the journey to a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old boy, or, you know, maybe this country's not for you. And, you know, it's true, right? So we all went along for the journey. We created this thing called the Rainbow Nation and what have you. But, you know, you say in a company is, you know, you need to have a culture. You need to have, you need to get your people in that want to do stuff with you. The same can be said for lots of different leaders, right? You look at the people that have made big marks and big sort of strides in life. Mandela's one because he made an impact in my life. But it's so important to have your people with you. And, you know, I like what you said as well, the wind in your sails. Mandela had the wind in his sails. He didn't want to go down the Mugabe route. He wanted to go down his route. And, you know, his legacy is something that obviously everyone looks back fondly at.
Yeah, it's really important. I mean, it's interesting that this analogy of maybe this isn't the country for you. It's like in America... Yeah. You know,
he said it. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
I'm only 12. He's like, yeah, boom. Have that. He delivered it.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, it's a very different worldview because like in the United States, it's like just mass patriotic sort of mentality all the time. Although we are like in a lot of ways, a series of countries that are kind of like together, you know, like I grew up in the South in Florida, and like, that's a completely different vibe than the Northeast, which is completely different than California. But yeah, like I think from a company standpoint, people have decisions that they're able to make, right? It's like, okay, first off, do I want to be a part of a big company or do I want to be a part of a small company? And there's benefits and drawbacks associated with each. You know, am I okay with not having a ton of structure, right? Yeah. Like when you're in a startup, you know, even on the outside when things, you know, like our business or whatever is, you know, like we're doing well and on the outside, like things are buttoned up, but like internally every single day, like it's always like, let's try to suck a little bit less today than we did yesterday. And, you know, just keep that mentality going, like small wins every single day. But, you know, even things like HR processes or whatever, it's like, you're like signing people up and you're like, I don't know, you know, like now it's like, yeah, I got to like figure this out. Whereas a big company, they're like, oh yeah, you go and see like this gigantic HR department and they'll get you like squared away, you know? Yeah. So it is one of those things where you have to like do a little bit of a self-assessment and figure out like what's important to you, what sort of work-life balance do you want to have, and you know, are you okay with the structural risk?
And you know, you guys right now, what are you, you know, just to sort of trade in TV, I mean, how, as you go forward, what are you doing to, you know, build up that brand identity, connect with the people that you need to connect with, even, you know, the communities that you need to connect with? What is your sort of your go-to right now?
So we're huge believers in Web 3.0 and being and giving early adopters and community members actual incentive structures where they can monetize for being early adopters. So a good example of that is we're launching an NFT in Q1 that will not just be like a digital avatar that has you know, swag or whatever on your profile name, but they'll actually have a series of benefits that are attached to it. We have a micro tipping coin that's used on platform for basically showing appreciation. So it replaces the traditional like button. And so we're thinking about a lot of cool things with that, but there'll be a token issuance in probably Q2 with that stuff. And then we go and we partner with great creators and we're putting a lot of resources into helping them build their brands and their businesses. Because ultimately that narrative becomes the Trading TV narrative, right? Like Trading TV was able to find a content creator who might have had 2,000 or 5,000 followers on whatever platform. And one of the things that they struggle with is, you know, they struggle with monetization. And so they don't make enough money making content. So they have to go and do some other job. Like my goal is to say, okay, look, like we'll put you in a position where you can focus on doing what you're passionate about and what you're really good at, which is making great financial content and helping people, you know, get involved in financial markets, make great investment decisions. And once that happens, you know, the flywheel effect starts to happen. But we're also really active, you know, in all of these cultural events on a seemingly weekly basis at this point now. So like NFT events and other conferences and things like that, where we're going to continue to build brand awareness and identity. You know, you're doing a lot of podcasts, you know, there's going to be some stuff that's coming out early next year that relates to television shows and things of that nature. So, you know, the brand building part of it for me is one of my favorite aspects. I really enjoy building the brand because, again, I think it's reflective of, you know, the mission and the cultural movement that we're operating in.
You know, you mentioned a second ago, you mentioned financial content. What type of financial content are you guys looking to put on your platform? And, you know, obviously then the financial creators that you're looking for.
Well, it's great from my perspective. We've moved into a world where everything is an asset. So that's kind of the tagline. Everything is an asset. Everyone is a trader. So what is financial content in 2021 and beyond? Well, it's anything that pertains to one of these assets that can be bought or sold with the intention of being able to make a profit. So ranging from the traditional stuff like stocks and options to crypto, DeFi, and then even getting into the alt stuff like NFTs, trading cards, rare sneakers, watches, wine. And so people can come onto the platform and they can talk about any and all of that stuff. And the format is live stream, video on demand, and immersive chat, similar to Facebook groups or Reddit subreddits or Discord servers. And then the audiences and the other users on the platform can buy and sell those underlying assets directly on platform. So it's really bringing this world of finance, which is ever expanding. Like, candidly, it's expanding much faster than like we can keep up with from a technology standpoint. But it's really bringing all those things into one centralized place because, you know, the world of finance has definitely evolved to the point where there deserves to be a standalone platform for it. You know, like I think in over the course of the last, you know, 2 or 3 years, certainly we've now gone to this place where there's tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people who are interested in these things now in a real way that probably weren't, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And I think the main impediment towards more people being involved, specifically in like crypto and some of the more complicated things, is this education aspect of it. So the content is really aimed at being an on-ramp so that you can become educated enough to start your financial journey. And once you get that content, then you buy and sell the stuff directly.
There's a lot of, you know, in the financial markets, in the financial space anyway, you go into YouTube and you go into these other channels. And, you know, I do feel that some of the advice, some of the, yeah, some of the advice, some of the education there is not exactly what I would think is the best education for everyone out there thinking of, you know, trading crypto or jumping into a different asset class. Because, you know, we want to give them the right education, but we want to give them the platform to go there and get the right education. So are you guys providing that safety net in a way? You vetting the creators, you're going, yeah, this guy's or this girl's great that they're coming on, and this person, yeah, not so great, they're not going to come on because we don't believe in them. And that's sort of what you're doing as well as part of this process?
So we have a very strenuous process as it relates to the verification of creators. So there's sort of, to take a step back, we give everyone the opportunity to create content on Trading TV. Why? Because we think everyone deserves an opportunity to be seen and heard. But if you want the Trading TV equivalent of like the blue check mark on Instagram or Twitter, then you have to go through like a very strenuous verification process. You actually have an hour long Zoom meeting with one of our community managers. You have to submit content. Like, you know, like we're not necessarily endorsing what that creator is saying. It doesn't mean that Trading TV is 100% in agreement with their opinions on something, but it means that like we vetted the person enough to be able to think that like they deserve to have a blue check mark and a verification badge such that people that come to the platform know that they're, you know, they're legit, so to speak. Now the question about like, you know, overall moderation and things of that nature and who do you listen to and not, like ultimately that is the problem that we all need to solve in life in general, right? Like everyone has, like, you know, your parents have an opinion about what, who you should marry and, you know, and like what you should do for a living.
And they are always right.
Yeah. You know, like, and so I think that's more about, you know, that's more about from an individual standpoint, what are your goals? You know, like if you're 45 or 50 or, you know, older or something like that, then you're entering kind of like the stage of your life where you need a more secure income stream. Then like maybe you come to the platform and you learn about crypto staking because like interest rates are so low and you're looking at, you know, a CD that pays 1% a year. And you're thinking to yourself, like, how do I take my nest egg that I've established over a 20, 30 year career and live off the interest when interest rates are zero? And so you want to figure out a way to earn 10, 15% by staking crypto, which is totally doable, by the way. And so, you know, that's your main thing. Another person might be in the very beginning of their investment journey and they have $500 and they want to like, you know, hit Solana over the course of the last year and watch it go from, you know, $500 to $500,000 or whatever the case is. It's different. So like, I think it's more about like bringing all of these different content creators across a myriad of different asset classes to the same platform and then giving the user the opportunity to sort of figure out which one is best for them.
Okay, brilliant. And we're heading into the final, is it quarter? Hockey, was it? Final third?
We call them periods.
So, periods. I was going to say half, but I'm a football and rugby player. So, you know, in this sort of period, we're going to have a flash round. Flash round is a bit of fun. It's three questions from me and then one question from you to me. So I'll kick it off. Let me know, what is the best advice you've been given on your entrepreneurial journey?
The best advice would be to approach every situation with empathy. I think that's really important. You know, like I think that there is a mentality when you're being an entrepreneur to be, I don't know, like overly aggressive and some like the try to be a shark. You know, like try to be like one of these people that just is ultimately cutthroat and competitive. But I think when you approach things with empathy and compassion and think about it from a holistic view, you end up making better decisions. And ultimately, like you're only as good as your reputation. Yeah. And you know, those things are like, it's tough to build and easy to destroy. Yeah. So I try to be empathetic and compassionate and caring about mostly the people that I work with, my investors, my employees. You know, and we still compete vigorously with all the other platforms that we compete with. But doing the right thing is always the right thing.
Brilliant. And okay, on the flip side of that, what's the worst bit of advice you've ever been given on your entrepreneurial journey?
Well, I mean, a lot of people told me not to do it.
There we go. To all those non-believers.
No, I mean, I think, you know, getting back to like the confidence thing, I don't believe that everyone has a great idea and that it's going to be able to be a successful entrepreneur. Like, there's going to be a lot more failures than there's going to be success. But when you say failure, there needs to be a definition associated with that. Like, people think if you fail in entrepreneurship, that means that like you're destitute, you're out on the street, and you know, you've gone from having a real job to, you know, to being a bum or something like that. Nothing could be further from the truth. When you start an entrepreneurship, whether the business succeeds or fail, you're going to be in a better position on the back end of it than you were previous. Point blank, full stop. That's the truth. You're going to meet people. You're going to meet people. Your network's going to grow. You're going to become a better operator. And like, these things just can't be simulated in sort of like a corporate environment. So yeah, that would be it.
Awesome. And this is a big one. This is the final one. So, best place, London or New York?
New York, obviously.
Oh, man. There we go. Okay, cool. And then over to you. Do you have a question for me?
I don't, off the top of my head.
Oh, come on. You got just one. Let's think of one. Just think of.
All right.
Think of something. I've told you about Mandela. I've told you about my roots in South Africa. So there must be something that you want.
Well, I guess I would ask, like, who's been the most impactful person that you've interviewed? And you're not allowed to say me, obviously. So who's the person, like, who's the guest that you've enjoyed interviewing the most?
Actually, I'm going to come back stateside. By the way, I love all the guests. So just to say he's putting me on the spot here. I do love all the guests, but I'm going to come back stateside. I'm going to say I had really good fun with David Breyer, New Yorker. I think he lives out in Pennsylvania now, but absolutely incredible entrepreneur. I think he's won the Presidential Entrepreneurial Medal like something like 10 or 20 times. So yeah, incredible guest. But to say that, you know, there's just been so many. I'm fortunate to have listened, had great interviews with guys in Africa, in Asia. Out in the UK and Europe, what have you, but David stands out just for
That was me teeing you up because I'm gonna ask for a connection to David. See,
I got it. So, there we go.
Yeah, go there ahead and reach out to him and say, you know, I did the show and you were mentioned as the greatest guest, and I'd love to get 10 minutes to your time if we could chat.
There we go. Well done, awesome one. So listen, awesome having you on the show today and really enjoyed our discussion. I guess if anyone wants to reach out to you and contact you guys at Trading TV, how should they do that?
Yeah. So first off, we have a website, www.trading.tv. The contact is at the bottom. It's hello@trading.tv for email. I'm on Instagram at Tobias_Francis. Same thing for Twitter. And then from a business perspective, I'm probably most responsive on LinkedIn. So Tobias Francis Heeslip on LinkedIn. And yeah, I'm actually, I'm a big believer in getting back to people, because that's one of the things that we talked about today. And that's been something that I've had success with people that I've tried to reach out to. So extremely responsive on all those different channels, and I'd love to chat.
Brilliant. And we'll wrap it up there. And everyone who's listening now, if you haven't subscribed to the channel, subscribe to it at www.scaleupconsulting.co.uk/media. This interview, and there is a treasure trove of information and knowledge in that library. So look forward to having you as a subscriber. Tobias, been awesome having you on the show today. Enjoyed it. And really looking forward to your continued success. It's an amazing platform you built.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.